Welcome to Real Film, the show where Jamie and Tom talk about movies that they want. Enjoy.
Welcome to the third installment of Real Punks. I'm Tom.
Jamie.
And tonight we're going to watch Contact, which is another sci-fi with Jodie Foster and Matthew McConaughey. Yeah, two actors that I don't have a whole lot of affection for.
Does he take his shirt off?
I don't think he does, no.
Alright.
I mean, we can probably find a film where he takes his shirt off if you really want to.
Watch it after, yeah.
Yeah, okay, great. I probably shouldn't be drinking during the intro. yeah, so I think we're probably best off just getting started with this. I mean,
yeah. Well, we were going to introduce that new bit where we talk about last week's film.
Oh, yeah.
I have nothing to add on Class of 94.
Yeah, I have nothing to add either.
All right, cool. Yeah.
Okay, but in general, in principle, we might discuss the things about last week's film that we forgot.
Yeah.
Or didn't realise.
That dawned on us over the week.
Yeah, you're standing in the shower and you're like, oh!
Because in case you didn't know this, dear listener, we literally watch the film and then press record as the credits roll. So,
as you might have noticed with the stellar backing track from Solaris.
Yeah, or the not quite so stellar Alice Cooper track from Class of 1984. Right, so let's get this shindig started then.
Hi, I'm Chris.
And I'm Frank.
And we have a weekly podcast called Are You Serious? In this podcast, we talk about current events.
And we talk about movies.
Politics.
People who bug us in the political world. Foolish things that go on.
We're two guys from Massachusetts.
We are definite blue staters.
I'm left-handed.
I have a left hand.
So if you're interested in hearing the news filtered through two belligerent, outspoken...
Sarcastic is probably a good word, too.
Sarcastic is a good word. Guys from Massachusetts, then tune in to...
Are You Serious Podcast.
Available on iTunes and at areyouseriouspodcast.com.
At all fine downloadable podcast places.
That's awful.
You can edit that out, right? That's the worst part. Just keep the rest of it, but get rid of what I said.
Okay.
Fucking fuck.
Buffalo rules, stay on. So we've just watched Contact. And I suppose I should explain why I chose...
You really should,
...to watch it. I want to start with three things. Well, I had three in my head, but I've forgotten what they were. The first one that I definitely remember is that I forgot how cheesy this film is.
It's very fucking cheesy.
Yeah, it feels like a bit like if Home Alone was sci-fi.
Yeah.
You can probably hear the music in the background. The second thing is... Oh, I remember the third now. So the second thing is that... just before the credits in this, this says for Carl, Carl Sagan or Sagan, I don't actually know how to pronounce his name.
He was the author, is that right? The writer?
Yeah, I think he probably was. But he was also like a fairly significant physicist as well as like a sci-fi writer. And I assume he died before this was released.
I think he died... This was 97, I think he died, like, 96?
Right, okay. But, I thought that was a nice touch. And then the other thing was that this film has been voted as, in some annual awards, by both a body of scientists and a body of, like fairly conservative Christians.
Right.
Like, in the same year, they both voted it as their kind of film of the year. Which, you know, is a pretty, you know, broad appeal. Like,
yeah, it's easy to see why, though. I mean, it definitely satisfies both camps.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, that's something that I could never do. Like, I don't have that, like, ecumenical approach to things. Like, I'm just a conceited asshole when it comes to, like, the way I present
myself. That's what it says in your CV. Tom Sharp, conceited asshole and atheist.
Mm. Yeah, so... You know, I think it's amazing that it manages to do that because I think it's very hard to stand in any one position and not really, like, feel pretty aggressive about the other one.
It's true.
So...
Jenna Malone, really?
I don't know who that is.
She's the one with the big eyes on Ally McBeal.
Oh, right, okay.
She's actually No, she can't be. That's not possible. 997, that's not possible. Okay. Must be a different general alone.
Okay. But,
sorry, carry on.
No, it's alright. Like, so... I was thinking of so the film starts, and it starts with this shot of Earth, and then you accelerate backwards.
Did you notice that Lagwagon was in there? Obviously we're called Real Punks.
Really?
So that's why I'd not be able to mention
where was Lagwagon?
It was the second track.
Really?
Yeah, oh, just after sick. Third Eye Blind plays by Third Eye Blind.
I didn't notice that. I like that.
I think it was Angry Days.
Right. So you know, accelerating backwards away from Earth and going backwards in time through the music that's presumably being transmitted on the radio as well, and you go past Saturn and out past Pluto and that outer asteroid field, and then out into the arm of the galaxy, and then past the galaxy, and then past all the other galaxies, and you just kind of keep accelerating backwards, and you get this kind of, it immediately puts you in this position of wonder about the universe, right?
Like, yeah.
You can't really avoid it. You just have this sensation of like, wow, fucking hell, like things are big, and it sets up for the first theme of the film, which I think is, and it's not touched on like on heavily, but it's there, which is the contrast between like wonder and certainty, in the sense that if you answer "I don't know" to questions about the universe, like the kid does at the end, you know, and Jodie Foster's character says, "Yeah, that's a good answer." You know, if you answer "I don't know," you're left in this position of wonder, right? Like, you don't know what is 10 galaxies over, like, and there could be all sorts of amazing things there, but you don't know, and you're in this position of wonder, and that's kind of a beautiful situation to be in, because when you look at the stars, you can just think, "Wow, like, what's out there?" But by doing that, you put yourself in this position of not having any grand sense of purpose about the universe, right? So, whereas in the contrasting position, where, you know, you are convinced that God made the world, made the galaxy, and until even fairly recently, that the heavens were just a single sphere surrounding the Earth at a fixed different distance, and all the stars were just points on that sphere.
Yeah.
And they were all the same distance away. And that was it, and outside that was heaven, right? And, you know, God had his kind of, divine design on things. So you have this, like, you know, it gives you a sense of origin and a sense of purpose, but without maybe even knowing it, you miss out on that just fantastic sense of wonder that you get from answering the like grand cosmic questions with "I don't know." And so, you know, that's, and there's no answer to it, like, which is the more fortunate position to be in. But that's the first theme that I think this film touches on. And then the second significant one is obviously, you know, the contrast between the two, like, dominant belief systems, dominant systems of thought, you
science
know.
And faith.
Yeah, yeah. And then the great crescendo towards the end, where is it Ellie?
Yeah,
Elliot. Yeah, Ellie. I'm really, yeah, really bad with character names. Yeah. So, you know, Elliot is convinced that, you know, she's been to
Eleanor.
No, is it?
Yeah.
Arwen, Dr. Arwen.
It's
Aaron.
It's
Erwin.
It's air something, because it sounds like they're saying like air hole or something.
Anyway, Jodie Foster's character.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, she's the only person who is at all convinced that she's been to the other side of the galaxy, and by her own admission and by her own measure of reality, she hasn't. Like, you know, as a scientist, like, she didn't go there, like, because, you know, she can't prove it, like, she knows better than to trust her, like, faulty sensory organs.
Well, she still believes, she trusts herself.
Oh, no, but the point is, like, until that point, she never kind of felt something so all-consuming that she just had to trust it. Like, up until that point, you know, if she'd seen a ghost or something, she would have said, right, well, my eyes are faulty because they don't exist.
Yeah.
And then, you know, she goes on this cosmic journey, or appears to go on this cosmic journey, and she has to fundamentally reevaluate the way that she, like, perceives her own perceptions.
Yeah. And I have a lot of problems with the film.
Right.
But my main problem is, obviously, we're going to spoil the fuck out of this.
Oh, well, yeah. So, I mean, there's no point listening to this if you haven't watched the film.
Yeah, right? Definitely. Yeah. But, my main problem is the fact that they didn't leave it... They pretty much said that she probably did go away for 18 hours.
I mean, I don't know if that means anything.
Well, like, it tips it towards scientific than towards... like it actually happening than it not.
No, I don't think it does. Like, because before the statement where they say, right, there's 18 hours of tape on this on this recorder, before that, there's absolutely no reason other than just like the pure emotional reasons to sympathise with Foster's character. Like, you obviously have this like pretty dramatic emotional association with her.
Yeah.
Because she's given this like grand speech. But a grand speech isn't any kind of empirical evidence. And
it's true.
You know, like I was thinking after she'd given that speech, I was thinking, what happened, like, you know, what if this had really happened? Like, and you know, how would she be perceived in the scientific community? And she'd be perceived as a crank. Like, she would still be considered a nut job. Like, she'd, you know, just because the film gives this like dramatic emotional crescendo doesn't mean that like the general community wouldn't still think she's a nut job. And so when you kind of take it, and I really do think like the author had considered this. I think he really had said, like, you know, at this point there is no weight to our argument at all. Like, it's just nonsense, so I need to give something to like even the scales a bit.
I don't know. I feel like that made it a lot less... what the fuck's the word? I can't think of the word.
Ambiguous.
Ambiguous is the word. Why didn't I think of that? I think it makes it a lot less ambiguous. It takes around 50% of the ambiguity away. Leaving it only 25% either way. But I don't think it does. I think it takes it like... I think it makes it so there's like a... it probably did happen rather than it didn't. It definitely...
No, I don't think it does.
It might not have happened.
No, because until that scene, it definitely didn't happen.
But it might have happened, but stuff happens where you don't have any
evidence. Well, actually, okay.
Like, scientifically, like, it didn't happen. Like, historically, it would never happen because it would just be someone's story.
So, yeah. So, I suppose my interpretation of this film is that it definitely did happen. Like, she definitely did go into this other galaxy. Right, I think that's the whole point of it. Like, I think it really is meant to be like, this definitely happened for her. Like, it really, you know, there were these aliens, they did communicate, she has gone to another galaxy, but the whole point of it is that it puts this otherwise, like, cold scientist in a position that suddenly she has to work on terms that don't make sense to her. Like, I don't think there's any ambiguity about whether or not she went. Like,
oh, I think there is. And I think really? I think if that was the point of the film, then that would be much earlier in the film.
What do you mean?
I think if the point of the film was to put this scientist in a position where she had to deal with stuff on terms of where she hadn't have, like, she wouldn't be able to deal with it scientifically, then that, I think that would happen much earlier in the film.
Well,
because then the story would be about how she deals with that and how she reacts to it. And
No, but that is really early on the film. Like, her dad dies within like the first 15 minutes, right?
And the
preacher's like, you know, sometimes God works in mysterious ways, and she's like, no, fuck that, I just didn't get the medicine fast enough.
Yeah.
Like, it already talks about from the start, and then she has to contest with like not even getting on the first crew to go on this mission because she didn't believe in God. Like, and she wasn't prepared to, you know, fake it. And yeah, okay, I mean, it's most obvious at the end, but like I said, I also don't think that's the only theme that's explored. Like, I think it, you know, it covers a lot of stuff.
There's the very literal relationship. No, well, there's that as well, but there's also
I don't want to sound like a broken record, but no, that's clearly a heaven allegory.
Yeah, no. I was watching that, and she goes and sees her dad, and
like a magical place in the sky where they shared somewhere in their youth.
Yeah. And you know, you also imagine that if you were, you know, obviously, I have a particular interpretation of this because of my own background and beliefs, but I imagine that if I was highly religious at that point, I would be thinking, oh, everything's gone wrong, she's dead and she's gone to heaven.
Yeah.
Like,
but that's what I thought. Maybe I'm religious, like secretly religious.
Yeah. But I think the whole point is that it's meant to provide, like, a whole load of ambiguity for people who would normally be completely set in their ways.
I'll be honest, the thing I was thinking the most when she lands on that, like, desert island place.
Yeah.
And the things walking up to it, I was like, please don't just be a really shitty CGI alien. Yeah. I don't think I can handle it at this point in the film.
Yeah. I think they were careful about that.
They were. I was really worried when I was walking up, and it had, like, it seemed to have, like, several Jar Jar Binks qualities. Yeah. I was just like, no, please don't do this to me. What I was going to say was, I think the most obvious theme in the film is the literal relationship between Jodie Foster's scientist, Matthew McConaughey's theological man, theologist,
word. Yeah.
Like the literal science versus faith relationship.
Yeah.
I think they couldn't have made it any more obvious if they like called it science versus faith, the motion picture. Yeah.
Redux.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that's obviously, those two characters are obviously meant to juxtapose the two approaches to.
But what they sort of say is that they can kind of, it almost in my head almost seems it seems like they're saying that they can live alongside each other and even interact in certain situations.
Yeah, no.
Which I don't think that's something that many scientists would agree with.
Yeah, I find that a little odd. Like, but the thing is, it genuinely causes me to question the topic again.
Yeah.
Right. So, like, when I see overt symbols of religion in public, I generally think, "The fuck is wrong with you?" You know, like, it does pop into my head, like, how can you possibly believe there's a man in the sky?
Right? Yeah.
Because, you know, I do genuinely hold that position. Like, why do you believe that there is a man in the sky? And it's a very kind of obtuse position to stand in. And I think this film takes someone as cynical as me and forces me to at least stop and kind of reconsider the question. Which is, you know, no mean feat.
Yeah.
And I think also it retains a lot of ambiguity in the sense that, you know, she gets into this pod and it drops into the rings, and to everyone watching it, it appears to just drop straight through.
Yeah.
And so the argument goes that, well, you know, if you want to believe Foster's character that says actually it went off to another planet and then came back, initially you'd think, well, actually you just have to have faith in that, right? You have to just have to have faith in her argument. But you can also take another perspective, which is that actually something happened that we just simply don't have the scientific tools to measure.
Yeah.
Which has happened throughout history, right? Like, countless episodes in science have occurred where things have happened that seem ridiculous, but you actually just can't measure them. So the classic one being the fact that quantum mechanics does stuff that is completely nuts, that doesn't make any sense. To, you know, you can have a particle existing in two different points in space in the same time,
but not at different times, as we learned from Time Cop.
Yeah, not as Time Cop told us. Yeah. And then when you try and measure these things, the whole thing collapses on itself and it doesn't work. And so there are things that can occur that aren't measurable.
Yeah.
Or even, you know, and then there are also things that can occur that you just don't have the tools to measure. And so, you know, I think I like that it leaves that ambiguity everywhere.
I'm not going to lie, I read a little bit about this film before we watched it today.
Right.
Because I was a bit worried.
Right.
Because
you weren't going to like it.
Yeah. And I mean, I liked it enough.
Yeah.
there was like I said, there was a million things that I didn't like about it.
Right. But we'll get to those in a bit.
Yeah, definitely. One of the things that I did read was that the author, the guy that wrote the screenplay and maybe the novel it's based on, is it based on a novel?
I think so, I don't know.
Right, well, if it is, then it's the novel it's based on, was acted as like the science checker man guy. That's right. The official title.
Yeah, yeah, checker man guy, yeah, yeah.
To make sure that all the science was spot on,
yeah.
or as spot on as it could be.
Yeah.
But they should have had like a bureaucracy checker man guy.
Right.
Because clearly, I don't believe that you would send a scientist into space.
Yeah.
I don't believe that they would take the scientist who makes the discovery, I just don't believe that they would send them into space.
Yeah, but the reason that Foster gets to go into space, or, you know, wherever she ends up going,
yeah,
is just because of some eccentric private interest in it, right? Like, she actually doesn't.
Yeah, but I don't believe that they would send a guy that's advised two presidents into space unless he was an astronaut.
Yeah, but astronauts are just scientists who've had a bit more training.
But, well, yeah, but he clearly never had the training. That's why my point is that the sort of bureaucracy that exists.
Yeah, yeah, no, but I think this is covered, right? Like, the first person who was meant to go was an astronaut and then decided not to because his family didn't want him to go, right? Because they thought...
But there's more than one astronaut in the world.
Yeah, 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 yeah. But I think it's reasonable to assume that if you had a group of people, like, they wouldn't all necessarily be astronauts, right? Like, I mean, you know, astronauts are usually almost always kind of, like... very competent scientists, but I mean, I don't know.
I think that's one of the many bureaucracy problems within the film.
What do you think? They only would have allowed astronauts?
Oh, well, I think they definitely would not let the two leading scientists involved in the thing go get potentially die in the effort to take them to space. Like one of them made what they discuss in the film as the most important discovery ever.
Yeah.
I don't think they would just send them, put them in a little ball and throw them into the sky.
Why not?
Well, because you'd send someone else first. At least to see if it worked.
Yeah, yeah, but this is potentially your one shot, right? Like, you know, you take your one shot and what if you send Cletus? Like, you've not done a good job.
It's true. Yeah. I also don't believe that they wouldn't tell them what to say when they got there.
Yeah.
Step for a man, or for man, or however it was meant to be that he got it wrong.
But let's assume that all that drilling goes on in the background. We don't really give a shit about it. Like, I'm sure they had international PR seminars.
But she didn't do it.
Not international. Intergalactic.
Yeah.
PR tutorials. But that makes for boring filmmaking. She didn't do it. She's accepted all of this bureaucracy because she was just picked by some eccentric, right? Like, he just said, quite early on in the film, right, I'm going to give you all this funding for your telescope. And then he took a shine to her and just said, right, you're going across the galaxy.
I hate that he died at the end. Completely pointless.
It was completely unnecessary, yeah. Well, no, it wasn't a necessary scene because otherwise you could have people wondering, you know, why didn't they just ask him if he would set up?
Because he was too busy flying around on the Mir space shuttle,
yeah,
the space station, which is obviously a real thing that happened.
Well, you're allowed some eccentricity. So what, you know? So what other problems?
Other general problems with the film: the dialogue is fucking atrocious, especially that child actor.
Yeah.
I couldn't place what the dad was in.
Ah, it rings a bell for me as well.
Is it the Green Mile? It might be the Green Mile or something like that. It's definitely something prison-y.
Right.
Or maybe Oz, I don't know. Although, they're pretty disparate.
But that's not a problem with the film.
Not at all, that was just the thing
that
I thought of then. Matthew McConaughey, he's a problem.
Really?
Just in general.
He's just disappointed he didn't take his shirt off.
I am.
Yeah.
It's like watching a Ryan Reynolds film where he doesn't take his shirt off. It's like, what's the point? You could at least shoehorn it in somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, Matthew McConaughey's delivery is a little bit weird, isn't it? It's like he put on a southern accent just to sound more religious and jobby.
That's how he talks.
No, it's not.
Yeah, it is.
Really?
Yeah.
All right, fair enough.
But...
No, but... Okay, well, so that aside, like... I think he has a pretty, like, spot-on delivery in the sense that he's meant to play this kind of... There's a certain... Okay, so there's a smugness about both parties.
Yeah.
But there is also a certain smugness about, like... about the people of God, in that, you know, they think they've got this divine mission. And that gives you a bit more smugness than just, you know, being a scientist. And I think he pulls it off quite well. Like,
well,
and he pulls that nonsense line about, like, you know, did you love your dad? And she gets all shocked. You know, she's saying, you know, you need proof to verify that things exist. And he says, did you love your dad? And he says, well, prove it. And this is meant to be... I mean, this is...
But she could just, like, go to the cupboard and whip out all the pictures and photos.
Exactly. I mean, this is the thing. I've actually been thinking about this recently, because I seem to remember having had the same conversation with someone else.
And Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah.
He didn't get it with Sheldon, did he?
Yeah.
That was after.
Yeah, afterwards, yeah. And it's kind of ridiculous, because the proof is right there on her face, right?
Hmm.
He said, did you love your dad? And immediately, her face went pale. So, you know, there are fairly obvious cues.
Yeah.
About that kind of thing. And even if it was less...
But you could ask him, is there a God? And he might get the exact same look. Obviously, that look is no proof of anything.
No. It's slightly different, right? In the sense that if you... So belief and love are two intangibles, right?
Yeah.
Now, if you show a picture of someone, say, you know, you've got someone and you show them a picture of someone they love and you get a response, then you know that person loves the person in the picture.
Well, yeah,
right?
Depending on the response. But
and then if you show another person a picture of their deity or whatever, and you get a response, you know that person believes in a deity. It doesn't prove they exist, right?
Yeah.
So in the same way that, you know, let's say I show a stalker a picture of their victim and you get a response, it doesn't mean that they've got a relationship. It just means that there's a one-sided...
Implying that Jodie Foster's character was stalking her dad?
No, I was implying that religious people are stalking God, but, you know.
Maybe everyone just stalks everyone.
Yeah, maybe.
But yeah, I just don't like him as an actor, and I don't like how he was just able to get. He's a theologian and an author, right?
Yeah.
He's allowed everywhere.
Just able to bust into the White
House. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know, like,
and he's invited to, like, nuts. Pick an astronaut to go into space.
No, but he's not. He sits on a council. You know, he's one of 20 people.
Well, but the idea of having him there, he's not even like any. Any vested interest in the project, apart from the fact that he's banging one of the main chicks?
No, but he does have a vested interest in the project, because, I mean, I think there were a lot more topics than they really had time to plumb in the film. But one of them was this idea of extraterrestrial life threatening the notion of God. Actually, well, that was.
I thought they dealt with that.
I mean, in the fact that there was a terrorist who blew up the whole project. Yeah. Yeah, and then at the start there was the kind of conservative Christian arguing that, you know, Christian morals came before this, and do these aliens even believe in God?
But I also thought that they dealt with the fact that aliens might even believe in God when she was up with the aliens or wherever she was, and they were like, yeah, we didn't build these tunnels, we don't know who it was,
oh,
maybe
shit,
they'll come
yeah.
back one day.
Yeah, I'd never thought about that. Yeah, yeah, which is actually a very biblical prophecy, right? And I mean, also the fact that that this alien takes the form of Foster's dad.
Yeah.
And I like she has this little lapse into irrationality, where she thinks it's his dad, and then actually steps back and says, "Wait, this isn't real. This is ridiculous."
Yeah.
And you know, it's made clear that this is all just constructed from her thoughts. But then the character who plays her dad says, "You've got your mother's hands." Now
I missed that line. I knew there was a line in that bit that I missed because I was making some sort of noise.
Yeah, so the father character, the alien father hybrid character, says to Foster, "You've got your mother's hands. Now, Foster's mother died in childbirth, so she'd have no way of knowing this." So it's either just a line that they've made up for the sake of sympathy, or it's this kind of suggestion that there's something a bit more grand going on and there's some greater knowledge than is available.
I really enjoyed, like, the green screen in the film. That's another really big problem with the film.
Right.
It was fucking terrible.
In what parts?
In the all the Bill Clinton parts.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah.
And in those parts as well, because they basically... It was the same thing, where they just filmed them against the green screen, so everyone had this sort of blurry outline to the side of their face, it seemed like all their particles were sort of coming off a little bit. And it was just awful, but I really liked how artificial everyone looked, including Foster, in that scene where she's in space.
Yeah.
Everything just looked sort of synthesised.
And
it may be, it's obviously something that they're saying with that, whether it's that it's not real or in space everything's hyper real, or that particular thing was hyper real.
Yeah, or I mean the setting they chose was fucking wicked. A tropical beach with a starlit sky just glued on top of it.
Yeah.
And super bumped up contrast and just this very dreamy kind of atmosphere. And that dreamy atmosphere giving this impression that, you know, that kind of implication that, well, if this is a dream, this is a hallucination, it's nonsense.
Yeah.
You know, there's no cold rigidity to it. And I really, really like the scene where she's passing through all of these wormholes and she goes past what basically looks like a space terminal. You know, it looks like a fucking intergalactic bus station. You know what I mean? It's just on the surface of a planet, just a ring of lights.
Oh yeah.
You know what I mean? Just concentric rings. And
that's what she says, they're alive or something.
Yeah. And this idea that this is a hub for all sorts of creatures from across the galaxy.
Yeah.
Across the universe. And that's what I mean when I come back to this whole point about wonder, is that when you have a universe worth of space to play with, you just have boundless limits.
Well, that's the if you boiled the entire film down into its simplest thing is, if there's no one else out there, it's a waste of space.
Yeah.
I mean, they say it about 4,000 times in the film.
Three times. But
it's literally, it's the start, it's the middle, and it's the end. It punctuates everything that happens in the film.
Yeah. But I don't know, I think that phrase is a bit too coarse for the concept, in the sense that it's not about it being a waste of space, it's about you being able to just let your imagination roam free.
Well, if infinite universe or infinite world theory is true, or is anything, then I don't know. That means everything. It means everything in the world exists.
Yeah. So there's this idea that if the universe is infinite, everything has to exist at some point, regardless of how improbable it is. So have you read The Hitchhiker's Guide?
Yeah.
So you know, they go to Squangela Zeta, and it's a planet populated entirely by mattresses.
Yeah.
Just because you go far enough through your infinity.
Does that mean that someone is a universe where God's real?
Yeah. I'm not... Yeah. So...
I set all that up just to say that.
No. Yeah, okay, fair enough. Right. So that idea is nice to start with, but I don't... So I've only fairly recently been introduced to the idea that there are different sizes of infinity.
Hmm.
So there's more than one infinity. Like, I don't know how many there are.
Is there an infinite amount?
I mean, I'm not even sure. Like, but I know there's... I can think of at least... I can explain two, and I have been told about at least three or four. So this idea of there being an infinite universe that everything has to happen. So this is not...
Explain it to me as if I was a child.
So this isn't... I was trying to think of how I'd explain this.
Tell me that you pretended.
No. And I think I've come up with an explanation. I don't think it captures everything, but I think it's a reasonable approximation.
Right.
Right. So, let's say you're standing in a corridor that's infinitely long.
Yeah.
And every metre, well, some arbitrary distance, I don't care what it is, there's a pedestal with a box on it. Right?
Right.
And you basically just have to open each box as you walk past it. Right? Okay. So, if you carry on for an infinite amount of time, you'll make it all the way down the corridor, like off into infinity, opening every single box, right? So this is the smallest size of infinity, right? Now, if every single box has an infinite number of boxes nested in it, like those little Russian nested dolls.
So like infinity squared?
Yeah, exactly, right? So...
Which is apt, because it's a box.
Yeah, nice one. Well done. Yeah, I've not come across that. But a box would be cubed.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. But you know, whatever.
In two dimensions, it'd be square.
Yeah, fair enough.
Unless it was rectangular.
Anyway, so every single box you come to has an infinite number of other boxes nested inside it.
Right.
Okay, so you get to the first box, and you open it. Now, you can either open the next box inside it, or you can go to the next pedestal.
That sounds like a really hard computer game.
But the point is, if you stand at this first pedestal, opening the infinite number of boxes on it, like inside, you'll never go off down the corridor, right?
Yeah.
And if you go off down the corridor, you'll never be able to come back to the first one to open the rest of them. So you have these two different infinities, right?
Yeah.
So the first infinity is smaller than the second one. So the idea that if you have an infinite universe, then everything has to happen, probably doesn't hold, because the sizes of infinity involved are probably different. But I wouldn't know how to.
Well, so I'm just well, it might just not fit into your analogy.
Right.
I was gonna say, I'm interested in hearing what the third, or indeed fourth.
I don't know.
I just wonder if that would fit into your analogy. Like if the box had an infinite number of bugs in it, and you had to eat them or something.
I have no idea. Like, so there was a guy called. Cantor, I can't remember, who demonstrated that, you know, that there were these different sizes of infinity, and named them with the Hebrew letters. So you have Aleph Null, which is the smallest infinity, and Aleph 1, which is the second largest infinity, and Aleph 2 and Aleph 3. If I'm even pronouncing those right, it might be Elf or Elf, I have no idea. I've only ever read them on paper, I've never heard them said out loud. So yeah, I honestly couldn't even begin to imagine how the rest of them work. I've never really figured it out, and I might even be wrong in my first description, right?
Well, but it seems quite reasonable. If it's a theory anyway, I don't know if it's a theory, if it's fact or what.
Well, I mean, it's the most pure kind of fact, in the sense that it's a mathematical theorem, right?
Yeah.
So you start with your initial axioms, the initial things that you hold to be true about mathematics. And then everything that you can derive from those axioms is also true. So, yeah, I mean, and this is, and that kind of is covered in the film, right? Like the mathematics is basically the only universal language.
Well, she says science, but yeah.
No. She does say mathematics to start with. So I mean, science is all just derived mathematics, right? Like physics is applied mathematics, and chemistry is just applied physics, and biology is just applied chemistry, and so on.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, and I think that's it's one of the few sci-fi films where they really cover communication between alien species, you know. And I think they do it quite neatly in this. They just start with this idea that, you know, the prime numbers are this kind of universally recognisable pattern, and then go from there.
Yeah, I guess that's the only real leap, besides, like, the idea that there's aliens or whatever, is that prime numbers are intergalactically recognised.
Yeah. But, I mean, any culture, regardless of where it is, that has any kind of concept of the ability to count individual objects must be able to figure out prime numbers.
Well, yeah.
If they were sufficiently advanced to transmit transmit radio signals. I mean, that's assuming that they even work. Like, you know, I mean, I think the point about this is that... so have you read Ender's Game?
So you said you were going to lend it to me. But it's the third in the trilogy, is it? Or
no, it's the first of four.
Right.
So the next books in the trilogy cover this idea that there are aliens that you simply cannot communicate with. There are certain alien cultures which are just so far removed from the way that human brains operate that you simply just don't, you cannot establish anything in common with them. So, you know, if that had been the case in this film, you would have got like 5 minutes in, and all, you know, all the unrecognisable signals they get at the start of the film might well be transmissions from those cultures. Possibly.
Yeah.
But the point is, the first one that they come across, which it can communicate with them, uses the most basic language that these two cultures would be able to have in common.
Yeah. One thing I was thinking was, it's really nice to see a film about aliens that doesn't use them as an immigration allegory.
Right, yeah, yeah.
It seems to be, and obviously it's the most obvious allegory. I've said obviously obvious in the same sentence about five times.
It's fine. I wouldn't worry about it.
But yeah, it's the most common or easy to arrive at allegory.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's nice just to not see that for a change.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But there is... Yeah, I think it would... I was going to say there is some kind of notion of, like, threatening our values, but I think actually it would be tenuous to draw that association.
No, yeah, it might be valid, like, if you get really deep into it, but I think on maybe the first three or four layers it's not there.
Yeah, I think the much, much stronger point in this is the whole idea of scientific discovery threatening
faith.
And I mean that's a theme throughout history, right? Like was it Galileo? Galileo was put under house arrest after he argued that the Earth revolved around the Sun rather than the other way around. It might have been Copernicus, I'm not sure. I think it might have been Copernicus who initially claimed that the stars weren't just a single shell that surrounded the Earth.
Right.
And he was frowned upon for this, and I don't know how severely, I really can't remember.
I went to Copernicus's house.
Really?
When I was in Poland, yeah.
No way.
It was good.
Yeah.
It was just a house. In
just
Poland.
A house.
Well, it was where he lived.
Yeah, yeah.
In Poland.
Mm.
They named a town after him.
Really?
Yeah. And this is completely irrelevant, but
no, no, no.
The houses there,
yeah,
they're all built on the small, like, they're all about the size of this room.
Right.
But really tall, like four or five stories up, because you only pay for the floor
land
space.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. And then, but they were all like, they were all really thin and really tall, but what's the word where it's like one big house?
Terrace.
Yeah, they're like pretty much terrace houses.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was so nice. Fucking Poland's amazing, man.
I've never been. No, it's, I think I have, but I didn't explore a lot of it.
Like, I had family. Well, I saw family over there.
Yeah.
They didn't all die. but yeah, I have family over there, so I go over every couple of years, and it's really good. It's a nice place. It's weird. It's weird that it's nothing like how anyone ever perceives it before they go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I think you find a lot of that. With mainland, can I call it mainland? Are we a part of Europe? I don't even know.
No, mainland Europe makes sense.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, when you go to sort of mainland places where people generally just don't go very much.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Like I guess you used to go to Prague as well before.
Before it became a destination.
Yeah. Before it became a stag night destination.
Yeah. Yeah.
The new Blackpool, Prague.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry. Yeah. Back on topic. Yeah, well, what was I even saying? Copernicus.
Yeah.
And his theory.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I can't remember what happened to Copernicus, but he presented this idea that actually the stars weren't this single shell that surrounded the Earth.
Mm.
And actually that they're all at various distances away, stretching off into unimaginable distances, which pissed off the Vatican no end, because they were starting with this assumption that actually the stars were a shell and beyond that was God's domain, it was heaven. And, you know, Galileo comes along and says, as far as I remember, and I must have so many factual inaccuracies in everything that I'm saying, but
if you use a lot of jargon, no one will notice.
Yeah, yes.
That's it. That seems to be how it works in film. So,
speaking of which, I heard my favourite rap ever.
Oh, really?
It's by a guy called Monzi, and it's called So Much Drama.
I hate Monzi.
Do you know who it is?
Yeah.
Really?
I was massive into nerdcore like a few years ago.
So like you've heard So Much Drama in the PhD?
Yeah.
And you didn't like it?
It's okay. It's on like whatever those compilations are. It's on like one of those.
You know what? Like his rapping is shit, but his lyrics are amazing. Like, just incredible. And like you say, like, just couch things in so much jargon that no one understands. But the line, what was it? By the time you've spat one line, I want to spit 10. You rap in exponential time. I'm in big O of log N. Like, I've tried to relay how amusing this is to about 10 people, and they look at me like, what the fuck are you talking about? But
I guess I don't get that either. But
no, I mean Monzi's stuff is, I mean, and this guy is like, he's a Stanford PhD student, like, so he knows his shit. I listen to half of that, literally, like half of the things in the song I kind of recognise but don't really know what they are, and about a third of them I actually kind of understand.
Right.
Like, and so I don't think it really has any appeal to anyone except as like a computer science graduate. Like, and maybe that's why you just don't like Monty.
It's true. I like a lot of those other nerdcore type people. I like Front a lot, and
right,
MC Chris.
Yeah, I mean, but there's different kinds of nerdcore, right? Like, if your nerdcore is about Nintendo games, then it's reasonably broadly accessible.
Yeah.
But like, if it's just about hardcore computer science, like I control my flow better than TCP, or you know, I'm going to beat your ass like a red black tree. Like, all of these things are just fucking hard to follow unless you're a computer scientist.
Like, I used to have all of those compilations. I can't remember what they're called right now. But yeah, they were good.
Yeah.
Some of them were better. There's like the hardcore Leet Posse or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And like stuff like that on them. And they were good. But didn't Monzi had a feud with another one of those nerdcore
like an actual feud.
Yeah, like who was it? Was it Beefy? It might be called Beefy.
Right.
My favourite of all that stuff is MC Hawking.
Right.
Which is basically someone just got the voice program that Stephen Hawking uses.
And then raps it.
And then the best one of that is all my shootings be drive bys. Basically like it's got like a narrative and he's one of his crew gets capped by someone from MIT.
Right.
So him and his little posse go and like shoot up MIT.
Amazing.
Sick.
Yeah, my shooting's been dry by.
Yeah.
But anyway, film. I'm interested to hear what else you didn't like, because aside from the like raw cheesiness of it, I really really enjoyed that film.
I enjoyed it a lot. I find the music was really
the music was, yeah, I mean the music was like I mean that's what made me think of Home Alone, right?
Yeah,
the kind of twinkly piano parts, just it was a bit of a shame, but
I don't like Jodie Foster. There were precious few roles where I can tolerate it, and this one was just about the right side of that.
I think we should try and think of someone who could have done it better, because I'm not saying there isn't anyone. I'm just saying that I'd like to think of who else we could have, if we were casting it.
Well, Matthew McConaughey is an attractive man. Let's put that on the table.
Right.
You're Matthew McConaughey, and you walk into a diner in Costa Rica.
Right.
Or Puerto Rico.
Oh, and you sit down and say...
You sit down and say, I want you to have dinner with me.
Yeah.
It's not Jodie Foster, is it?
Well, I don't know. I think she's got a certain charm to her. But yeah, she's I've always been a bit weird looking.
Yeah,
yeah.
And like, even at the point where she has her breasts pretty much out, when she's all dressed up.
Yeah. So, Maybe, no, I think Sigourney Weaver would have been too stoned for it. Like, Sigourney Weaver couldn't have done... And the only reason I brought her up is because she's been in other sci-fis.
Mm.
But I think she wouldn't have done, like, the kind of...
She basically did a very similar role in Gorillas in the Mist, which seems like a weird comparison, but I think the role is quite similar.
Yeah. But I think she doesn't probably have the kind of vulnerable thing that Jodie Foster's got going on, which is necessary for the conclusion of the film.
This was, what, 97? Who else was big in 97?
I was thinking of doing it anachronistically. Like, I wasn't planning on...
Well, we just cast it with whoever's about.
Yeah. Or whoever you want, really.
Yeah. Well... You want someone with, like, a next-door neighbours-y sort of attractiveness, but can also carry the weight of being a scientist and not looking like Matthew McConaughey. Because I frankly just don't believe him as any sort of theologian
right.
at all. I totally buy the idea of someone who studies sort of the Christian faith and then decides that they'd rather bang people than not.
Yeah.
But I just don't believe that he'd be Matthew McConaughey.
No, I think you need to give him a bit more credit. Like, I think his character's a bit more complex than that.
Well, but he basically says that. He basically says, I would have been a priest, but I wanted to have sex.
Yeah, no, that's cool. But...
And now I'm going to have sex with you, Jodie Foster.
Yeah. But I think he also, you know, he also expressed kind of disagreements with the religious orthodoxy. You know, he's definitely a maverick. He's a maverick of the cloth.
Well, if he's a maverick of the cloth, then he wouldn't be allowed into the White House.
No, but that's why he's allowed into the White House. Because the White House... I mean, large chunks of America...
Would you say that Fred Phelps is a maverick of the cloth?
Who's Fred Phelps?
He's the leader of the Westboro Baptist Church.
No, he's a nut job of the cloth. As in, like, the Waco...
Westboro's God Hates Fags.
Yeah. Fags hate God, you know.
Yeah. That's a limp wrist t-shirt.
Yeah, it's wicked.
Back to real punks.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Okay. No, but I mean...
Would you let him in your White House? If you were president...
Is that an innuendo?
If you were President Clinton...
I think if I was President Clinton, I would only let Monica Lewinsky in the White House.
Really? She wasn't even that hot?
I know, but still, you know, presidential...
To be fair, like, anyone who let you put a cigar in them...
Well, that never happened.
I read it in the paper.
Can we just change the subject? Can we get back onto the initial question?
So, is Fred Phelps...
That wasn't the initial question. So... Who else could have played this? I mean, I don't even like any actors. Like, I can't even think of any that I particularly like.
I think, right, Rachel from Friends as Jodie Foster and Joey from Friends as Matthew McConaughey.
But when you say as Friends, like, as Friends from Friends.
Yeah.
So they're literally playing the same characters.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's actually just the case that Rachel happened to... just wander into this research lab one day. I went, oh, that's a pattern. And then just got rocketed to the front of...
Yeah.
With no sound in it back.
She just heard, she heard the sound. Like, do you know the beginning where she hears that weird sound and she listens to it?
Yeah.
And the autistic guy...
Was he autistic? No, he's blind, you idiot.
What the fuck
is wrong with you?
But, like, his delivery was so autistic. He reminded me so much of Rain Man.
He's a scientist. That's what scientists sound
definitely
like.
Definitely six.
You haven't...
That's my impression of autism, by the way.
Yeah, it's pretty awful. Yeah. You haven't heard half of the people that I work with.
Well, obviously I haven't. But I've heard some of them, but they don't sound that bad.
Oh, whatever. Like, me included, on bad days, sound a lot worse than him.
Well, he came across fairly autistic.
It's bullshit. That's absolute bullshit.
Just watch his... Like, when you watch it again, or when we're done with this, right, I'm going to make you watch that scene where he's introduced again... And see if he doesn't show any autistic.
Yeah, he's a tendencies. Nervous, blind scientist. Like, if anything, Jodie Foster was too socially confident. You know what I mean? Like, Jodie Foster was too attractive for the role. Should have been much more ugly and much more stuttering.
But your man, Bromlin, whatever his name was.
Bromlin?
The Captain Science.
Captain Science 2000.
Yeah. Captain Takeover Man.
The head of the Science Foundation.
Brundlin.
I know what you mean. The head of the Science Foundation who puts himself to the front and goes on the initial mission set up.
He was very socially...
Yeah, but here's the thing, right? So the rank and, I reckon the rank and file of scientists are, you know, probably... Well, actually, that's bullshit. I don't even know what I'm talking about. But...
it's all conversations apart.
No. My point was that, yeah, of course he's socially assertive. How else would he have become the head of the National Science Foundation? Do you know what I mean? Yeah. You don't get timid people being the head of multi-million dollar
endeavours. So we didn't talk about
endeavors. What?
How much I fucking love James Woods.
Who's that?
He plays Kits or Cats or the NSA guy.
Oh yeah. He's ace. I fucking
love that guy.
Yeah, and he plays an amazing dickhead in this.
Yeah, I would cast him in every role.
Yeah, yeah,
like, every single one. Yeah, he's Jodie Foster.
Yeah,
he's Matthew McConaughey. He's himself, and he's the other guy. He's the aliens. He's everyone.
He's the aliens. Yeah.
It's like that scene in Being John Malkovich when John Malkovich goes inside John Malkovich's own head, and everyone is John Malkovich, but with James Woods.
Sick. I did like him in that, and I also like that the whole film is fairly respectful of everyone involved, except idiots with guns.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's completely clear that that guy is an utter chode. There's no ambiguity about it.
Yeah.
But everyone else, fair amount of respect. You know?
Apart from, like, your science Captain Takeover prick.
Well, yeah, I mean, he was just a prick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, prick and a chode are pretty close together, I would say.
No, a chode's a lot wider and shorter than a prick.
Wide? Well, yeah, but they're pretty close together. They sleep together. Are you suggesting that Captain Science Takeover was sleeping with James Woods?
I think we should probably neatly segue into another topic.
So, on our arbitrary scale...
Well, don't we normally conclude with arbitrary scale? I mean, the time has passed. Yeah. We're at arbitrary scale rating.
I think the way we should rate, I know that we discuss this every time and it's different. We should rate films whether they're better than the films that we've watched before. Maybe like the last 9 films.
But how do you compare them? Like,
well, we can compare that on Solaris. Have you noticed that we spent 66% of our time talking about science and religion?
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other 33% talking about Youth Gone Wild.
No, I'm going to carry on using my normal ranking scale, which is
just what, 10's the best film in the world.
Yeah.
Or 10's your favourite film ever, which
and
is zero
is the least favourite. Yeah.
What is your favourite film ever? Definitely wasn't Repo Man, was it?
No, it wasn't Repo Man. I don't know. I think they all have to, like, my few favourites have to cluster around the high 9s, and I'd struggle to remember 10.
Yeah.
Because I just never can remember what my favourite film is. You know, I always watch something again and then go, oh, that was my favourite film. But, I mean, things like Brick, I've got to admit, despite it being a bit of a cliche, just because everyone fucking loves it, Inception's fairly high up there.
I think it's always a bit too new.
Yeah. But anyway, so this topic aside, before we discussed this film, I was thinking like an 8.2. But now we've discussed it, just because the kind of initial impact of it's worn off, I'm down to kind of a 7.8.
I give it a 7.
Yeah? I'm surprised. I thought, I didn't, especially as it got cheesier and cheesier, I thought I really thought I would be losing your attention.
I think the conversation we had about the film is better than the film.
No, absolutely not. Because I don't want to have this conversation in 10 years' time over and over again. I intend to watch this film, you know, once or twice every couple of years. I'm happy
to come around here and talk about this with you every couple of years.
I'm going to do plan.
Like, not move on at all. Just the same conversation,
same
word for word.
Yeah. But, you know, I was planning on, you know, showing this film to someone who turned out to be a massive knobhead, but, you know, someone who said she was really into sci-fi and was studying the religion
I think she, I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, I think you probably do know who I'm talking about. You know, she was studying, she was actually taking a degree in theology, but really enjoyed sci-fi, and this would have been an ideal film. And I'm sure I'll come across people again who, you know, have all sorts of ambiguities in their perspectives on things. Yeah. And this is just a brilliant film. Like I said, you know, it was given these high accolades by completely disparate bodies, like religious and scientific bodies, and I think it, I enjoyed that a lot watching it again, and I can definitely imagine showing it to other people.
Right.
Whereas,
like, you know, I liked it a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, there's enough fundamental problems with it, mainly with the dialogue, some of the acting,
yeah,
the direction, and the music, which are the obviously four main things. But once you get past that, like, I'm giving it like a 6 just for content, and then a 1 for the actual film.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean that's kind of my point. Like, it carries these pretty immense issues, and it does them really in a really balanced approach.
Mm.
You know what I mean? And I honestly think the only bigger issues to be discussed, and maybe they're actually parallel, is the kind of, you know, how do we go about producing a society which is organized in a fair and sustainable way? Like, so that's a completely different set of issues, but I think it's probably at the forefront of the, you know, importance to be discussed. And maybe it's a little bit more important than these debates between religion and science, because they're rad, but they're a bit abstract.
Whereas, well, they're very abstract. They're almost entirely abstract.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. But, yeah, I mean, they're definitely nowhere near as important as, you know, how do we provide water and sanitation for all the population that doesn't have it.
Yeah.
But I think they're definitely the second issue in line after the topic of social organisation. Like, and, so, you know, it covers these, like, huge...
Are there any films about social organisation that you can think of?
So, off the top of my head, I think V for Vendetta covers a lot.
Like, there's quite a bit in Children of Men as well, I'd say.
Yeah, they're very similar films.
Yeah.
I mean, then there's... I've not seen it, but Land and Freedom, apparently, is basically a film remake of George Orwell's memoirs of the Spanish Civil War, which should be really interesting.
That does sound interesting.
Yeah. I do think film was a pretty powerful device for covering that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I think it's been done a lot.
One of the things I sort of want to touch on with you tonight, but I don't think we'll have time now, is the idea of... There's something I was thinking about today, the idea of being fairly anti-capitalist and also supporting the film industry.
Right.
Which are obviously two completely disparate things.
Mm.
I mean, the film industry is one of the most capitalist industries that exists.
Yeah.
But I think it's a massive conversation that we just can't afford to have on our battery power.
Yeah, probably not. No.
So it's maybe something that we should touch on another time.
Yeah, I mean, having said that, like, I reckon I can summarise, like, my perspective on it in very few words, which is that, you know, within the framework of capitalism, you can't come up with any logical, sensible approach to, like, supporting a particular industry or, you know. So the idea being that, oh, you know, you've got to buy films because that supports these people so they can da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It's like, it's complete nonsense. Like, it's logic that exists entirely because money exists.
Mm.
And when you remove capitalist motivations for things, then the whole underlying logic of having to provide money for them in the first place just evaporates. So, you know, having artistic endeavour exist purely for the sake of artistic endeavour, and those people involved in the artistic endeavour continue to be clothed and fed and housed as long as the work they do is considered significant enough by the community to be worth clothing and feeding and housing them.
But I think that makes an interesting conversation about, like, budgets as well. Like, you can never judge a film by its budget, because its budget would always be zero, or would always be X amount of labour
rather than
X amount of millions of dollars.
But yeah, I mean, it is an interesting topic. And you know, it goes for almost everything. You know, when people talk about spending cuts, and all sorts of, you know, fiscal austerity measures and things like this. Like, yeah, I mean, they make a reasonable amount of sense in the logic of capitalism, but the logic of capitalism is just fucking nonsense. Mm. So the whole thing kind of falls apart when you actually consider that it makes a whole lot more sense to organise your economics just around the fact that there's actually a vast excess of material wealth to start with. So if it's organised and distributed sensibly, there's no need for, you know, austerity measures and hedge funds and all these other like ridiculous things that grow out of a monetary economy.
I feel like we're losing all of our non-anarchist, anarcho listeners.
Fuck them. Fuck them. Don't care.
So
they're all wrong.
You said what? 7.8%, 8.2%. What?
You know, I oscillate. I'm gonna sit in the middle and go
eight
with an eight. Yeah. Or No, I'm gonna go with an eight. Like, I'm gonna be confident about it.
Yes.
Yeah. Like I said, you know, loses points for being cheesy.
But it only loses 2 points from say Brick.
Yeah.
Or from say Inception. Yeah. Which I haven't seen, so I'm just pulling things out that you've said before. But it's only two behind those.
Yeah,
maybe films.
Maybe it should be a 7.8. It should be in the high sevens. I just think the themes it explores are fucking wicked.
They really are. It's really well written. That's the highest praise I can give it.
So maybe I should give it a 7.7. I think I should pull it down a bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
I still give it a 7. Yeah. I think a 7 is.
Yeah. I think that's a good number.
Yeah.
Yeah. If we say what that I was giving Solaris.
Well, you put Solaris in your nines, didn't you?
In a 9, and I gave
Class of
1984 a kind of 6.5-ish. So yeah, I think that's reasonable. Yeah. I mean, we could fiddle numbers for fucking ages.
We could fiddle numbers for fucking ages.
Yeah.
But then we'd be just as bad as them fucking capitalists.
Yeah. So what were you thinking of
watching next week? Not decided at all.
Right.
When I say I'm not decided, it doesn't mean I've decided. I've not decided.
Yeah.
I was thinking maybe Kingdom of Heaven, which I have not seen.
Okay, I'd be into that. Like, because I kind of want to see it as well. And you were saying that apparently it's rubbish until you see the director's cut, which adds stuff back in that isn't rubbish anymore.
Apparently that's what I've heard.
Yeah.
But I might change my mind. So it's a situation a bit like last week, where we were going to do Contact.
Yeah, well,
and then we did.
Yeah,
but
that's just because I couldn't find anything else that I actually wanted to watch, and now I'm happy I did watch Contact. Yeah.
Well, I'm thinking probably King of Heaven, but I don't know for sure.
It would be interesting to watch something that neither of us have seen,
yeah,
because then no one's to blame and no one's held accountable for it. Like, oh,
I'll be held accountable because
you won't have known it. Like, I picked Contact knowing full well what was in it.
Yeah.
So I had to defend it. Do you know what I mean? Whereas if you pick something that,
same as I picked Platinum 1984.
Well, exactly.
Which you liked considerably less than say I liked Contact.
Yeah. So you know, rather than this being an issue of like defense and attack, it can just be, and if it's really bad, it means that we can just both rip into it, and it'll be great.
It's true. I doubt it would be that bad. It's Ridley Scott. It's going to be fucking, it's going to look amazing no matter what.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of why I'd be excited about it, because it does look very cool.
Yeah. It also, I think on the DVD cover.
Yeah.
I think that, what's his name from Pirates of the Caribbean? That British actor who's completely wooden.
I have no idea.
Orlando Bloom.
Oh, okay.
I think he looks like Fisher Stevens in,
you've completely
Short Circuit.
It's been so long since I've seen
Johnny Fiver's alive. Yeah, amazing character that's so like beautiful and completely
so multifaceted.
Yes,
you know, such an such a beautiful ethnic portrayal.
Yeah, like, even better when you realise that he's a white guy.
Or painted brown.
Yeah, pretty much.
Sick.
Well, I think that Orlando Bloom in on the DVD cover at least of that film looks exactly like that character.
Right. Okay.
So excited. To see how
I'm sold.
I'm excited to see. Well, it's a film about the Crusades as well, so I'm sure we can have another religion fuel discussion. We have to sort of move away from.
There wasn't a whole lot of science in that, apart from.
There was loads of science in the Crusades. Didn't they use guns and stuff? Didn't science make guns? Science makes swords. They melt metal in that.
Yeah.
They melt metal using science.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. That is science. Well done.
Right, so let's just wrap this up, shall we?
Yeah.
If you want to give us a email on the email address, that's realpunks, R-E-E-L-P-U-N-X, @gmail.com. Don't forget to tell your friends. We had a bit of shitty downloads this week.
Really?
Yeah, terrible.
Well, I think that's because it's not really worth listening to.
We're miles under the other show that I used to.
Really?
Yeah, like, not even, like, maybe 10%.
I mean, I think it's optimistic that even anyone's listened to this point.
It's true. Yeah. It's possible.
Yeah.
If you listen to now, send us an email telling us to fuck off.
Yeah.
Call us cunts. Send us an email saying you're cunts, and then we'll know that you listened to the end.
Yeah.
Or that you think we're cunts. Either way.
It's ambiguous.
Yeah.
Be contact all over again.
It will. Except with cunts. Contact.
That's right.
Right. Bye.
They say that